as Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei highlights the significance of elections in the country and warns against the enemy's plots to create rifts between people and the Islamic establishment. Iran marks the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Thousands of people stage a rally in the northern Yemeni city of Sa'ada to slam policies of the U.S. and its allies in the region. Welcome to the program. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has warned against the enemy's attempts to create rifts between the Iranian people and the Islamic establishment. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was addressing the nation on the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of Iran's Islamic Republic's founder, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Khamenei highlighted the significance of elections in Iran. He stressed that Imam Khomeini viewed election as the manifestation of people's will and stood firm against hegemony and corruption. Ayatollah Khamenei also referred to the upcoming presidential vote. He said the existing shortcomings should not discourage people from having political participation. The leader also recommended that people consider deeds rather than words of the presidential hopefuls and urged the candidates to avoid making hollow promises. He urged influential figures to encourage people to participate in the election. Iranians have marked the 32nd anniversary of the departure of the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. On the occasion, a ceremony was held at the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini in the south of Tehran, and that's where Youssef Jalali has filed a report from.
June 4th on the Iranian calendar marks the passing of one of the most influential figures in modern history, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini was a man who led the Islamic Revolution to victory in 1979 and established the Islamic Republic in Iran, putting an end to decades of autocracy. On the 32nd anniversary of his demise, Iranians paid tribute to him by congregating at his mausoleum in south of Tehran. As with every year, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, delivered a speech on the occasion. Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989 at the age of 86, almost a decade after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which saw the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime in Iran. Imam Khomeini spent many years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately put an end to millennia of monarchical rule in Iran.
Imam Khomeini was like a savior to our nation. The U.S. and the U.K. used to exploit the wealth of our country by controlling our oil industry. The Islamic Revolution took back our independence and allowed us to have a say in our fate by taking part in different elections.
Many lives were lost in the path of the Islamic Revolution. To us, the revolution represents our identity as Muslims, so we have to preserve what our fathers and grandfathers fought for and not let Imam Khomeini's legacy go to waste.
Imam Khomeini established the Islamic Republic following a referendum held in 1979, when more than 98% of eligible Iranians voted yes to the Islamic Republic.
3 decades into his passing, Imam Khomeini is still remembered as the pioneer of a new era in Iran's history. An era that put behind centuries of monarchies and brought about a new political system that honors Islamic values and seeks to be independent of foreign powers. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
Welcome to the Omni News Line. Although the United States has toned down its anti-Iran rhetoric in recent months, Washington still makes sure all sanctions against Tehran are enforced. A case in point was the recent seizure of an oil tanker believed to be carrying Iranian crude.
Commodities traders in the United States came across something surprising last week when the U.S. Energy Information Agency released its new figures. The EIA figures included Iranian crude oil for the first time in decades. The government statistics and court documents show the U.S. has sold about 2 million barrels of Iranian crude after seizing an oil tanker off the coasts of the United Arab Emirates. American authorities say they brought the Liberian-flagged tanker Achilles to Houston, Texas in March. It was ordered to discharge its cargo at the port of Galveston. The crude from the oil vessel, which the U.S. says was transporting Iranian oil, was then sold for $110 million. American officials say the tanker was covertly transporting the cargo to China in violation of U.S. sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. U.S. court documents also allege the vessel was subject to forfeiture under American anti-terrorism statutes. Some observers have described the seizure as illegal under international law and argue that it amounts to piracy.
I mean, it's piracy, it's theft. It's amazing that the United States can appropriate to itself the right to do such things. This exceeds even, you know, the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was a cruel empire within its boundaries, but it couldn't go outside of its boundaries and tell the rest of the world what to do.
Anti-Iran hawk former U.S. President Donald Trump has been gone for months now, but the United States has kept up its anti-Iran policies under Democratic President Joe Biden.
The United States has imposed many rounds of sanctions against Iran. Many of these anti-Iran measures were imposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who was very close to the sworn enemy of Iran, Israel. Before coming into office, his successor pledged to change course regarding Iran, but that pledge remains to be fulfilled.
The recent seizure of the oil tanker was a stark reminder that America's anti-Iran measures are not ending. Many such measures were reimposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who abandoned the hard-earned 2015 Iran nuclear deal. His successor, Joe Biden, says sanctions are not exactly his favorite, but the anti-Iran measures are being fully enforced under his watch. The Islamic Republic's oil shipping and banking are among the sectors targeted by America's unilateral sanctions. Iran has repeatedly described America's measures as economic war. The American sanction mechanism has made it extremely difficult for Iran to purchase some essential goods like medicines. The American president promised a shift in U.S. policy on Iran, but he has so far failed to fulfill his pledge to change course.
As far as its foreign policy goes, this is truly the neocon foreign policy. These are the actors from the Obama administration, people who had key roles when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, like Campbell and Sullivan, people who are now in these critical positions inside the administration, and Samantha Power at AID, and so on and so forth, who really were able to impose the most terrible sanctions on Iran.
The United States and Iran say they are willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held several rounds of talks in Vienna aimed at restoring the half-dead nuclear deal. Diplomats from the United States have been present in Vienna and talking with their P4+1 counterparts. There have been some signs of progress in Vienna, raising hopes for a revival of the international nuclear agreement. But critics believe that even if the U.S. returns to the deal, past experience shows that there is no guarantee that the U.S. will honor its commitments in the future.
The Yemeni people have rallied in the northern city of Sa'ada in a show of resistance against their enemies. Demonstrators chanted slogans and slammed policies of the U.S. and its allies against nations in the region. They also expressed sympathy with the people of Gaza that was hit by 11 days of Israeli attacks last month. The Yemenis condemned the Israeli killing of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. In her final statement, the Yemeni protesters called on all Muslim nations to boycott American and Israeli products as part of efforts to resist their aggressive policies. The statement also called on the Yemeni people to stand against aggressors. Palestinian groups in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip say there is no chance of Israel changing its policy under a new cabinet. In our news review program, we discussed that matter with our guests. And before we go, let me just update you on this latest breaking news on your screens right now that says at least 15 Palestinians have become injured during anti-settlement protests in Beita village in Nablus. Let me just reiterate that for you. It's at least 15 Palestinians have been injured. No reports of death so far, but 15 injured in clashes that were done against settlements and within the settlement protests that have happened in Beita village. That is in Nablus. We're trying to dig more information on that as far as that story goes. But regarding what I just read, here's what we did.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Palestinian groups in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip say that they do not expect to see any difference in Israel's policy under a new cabinet. A representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization said that Israeli Prime Minister-designate Naftali Bennett is an extreme person, just like Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said it will make no difference who's in charge of the regime. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem said all Israeli cabinets in the past were expansionists and were hostile toward Palestinians. And now joining us for the program is Mr. Bruce Katz, co-president of Palestinian and Jewish Unity, joining us from Montreal, and Rabbi David Feldman, spokesperson for Nitzrei Karta International, joining us from New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Rabbi David, we're going to start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. Your thoughts on the prospects of anything changing when it comes to the way that Palestinians are treated there in occupied territories now under this new Israeli cabinet?
Well, unfortunately, we see these difficulties that Israel had to form this cabinet, and they say that they're doing some changes here, but we need to understand that the root problem is still around. You know, nobody is up here to realize that what was done to Palestine originally was wrong. Unfortunately, we find that, these people from Jewish descent trying to educate the masses on this false propaganda that the Palestinians hate us and we need to hate the Palestinians, we need to oppress them in order to build this Jewish state. Unfortunately, all of this is so wrong according to Judaism, and this is basically the foundation of all misery and all conflict and all wars that we are experiencing all these decades. Unfortunately, unless they will realize that they need to get back to what Judaism taught us in the very beginning, that all of this is forbidden, unless they would be willing to give up this entire occupation, unfortunately, nothing is going to change.
Thank you, Rabbi, and Mr. Bruce Katz. Pleasure to have you on the program once again. Hope you're doing well. Bruce, your initial thoughts on this?
Well, Israel tries to sell, once again, to sell the story that somehow, with Netanyahu out of the way, at least for the time being, nobody knows what will happen in the vote that's to come, and he's still working behind the scenes. But choosing somebody who, unbelievably, can be considered to the right of Netanyahu, which seems unbelievable in itself, does not augur very well for the immediate future. We need to remember that Bennett is the settler's man in the Knesset. He's categorically opposed to Palestinian self-determination, categorically opposed to the creation of a Palestinian state, and he said as much in an interview with the New Yorker magazine in 2013. He's in favor of annexation. He proposes annexing all of the illegal West Bank settlements and the Jordan Valley. He's a particularly dangerous individual in the sense that he also proposes Israeli control over the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, and those are his followers who went into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and provoked Palestinians at prayer. That needs to be remembered. And if anybody doesn't remember, let help them recall that in 2013, during a cabinet meeting, when he was a minister in the Likud-led coalition, Bennett is on record as saying that he's killed a lot of Arabs and he has no problem with it. So when you have this type of an individual as having been given the mandate of Prime Minister of Israel for 2 years, what does that tell you about the Israeli political system and Israeli society? It's a failure. Any society that elects war criminals successively to lead the country is a country that has fallen into a certain degeneracy. And today, Israel is absolutely no place for progressive-minded Jews, and that's why progressive-minded Jews are leading Israel in great numbers, and that's not being broadcast for obvious reasons.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Please do stay safe, both of you. Bruce Katz, co-president of Palestinian and Jewish Unity, joining us from Montreal, and Rabbi David Feldman, spokesman for New Torah Karta International, joining us from New York. And that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
To other news now, China has accused the U.S. of, quote, suppressing its firms after Washington blacklisted more Chinese companies. Beijing has urged Washington to respect market law and principles. It also promised retaliation if the ban remains. On Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden added 28 Chinese companies to a list of firms that American entities are prevented from investing in. The list already contained 31 companies, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, had blacklisted. Washington accuses all these companies of having links with China's defense or surveillance technology sectors. The ban has been among issues of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past year.
Here at IRIB English Radio, express our heartfelt condolences to all of our listeners. On the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul.
It's Parliament that makes the headlines with legislation, but no bill passed by Parliament or Majlis becomes law without going through the Guardian or Constitutional Council. Less in the spotlight normally, there are times when this Council of Elders becomes the highlight of the day. One of those times is elections, be they parliamentary, presidential, or assembly of experts elections. What exactly the function of the Guardians of the Constitution is when it comes to elections is the focus of our study in this episode. The 12-member Guardian Council of Legal Experts supervises elections and approves or disqualifies candidates. It also has veto power over legislation. It's something of an upper house, so omitting it from Iran's legal system would be unthinkable. However, it does come under scrutiny and criticism from time to time, especially with the 2021 elections. I'm Leila Faramayzi. Council chaired by Ayatollah Jannati approved only 7 candidates to run for president in the June 18th election. That was out of a total of 592 prospective candidates, 552 men and 40 women. The list of candidates or finalists was communicated on May the 25th and has since kept eyebrows raised with foreign critics who incessantly bring the Conservative Council under attack. Mr. Atrianfar is among those at home expressing displeasure at the Guardian jurist's election. He is a reformist and member of the executives of Construction Party, who met with us at Press TV Studios.
هیچگاه نباید نهادهای حقوقی به خصوص شورای نگهبان جدگیری سیاسی داشته.
Legal institutions, especially the Constitutional Council, must never be politically biased. The council was expected to adhere to this standard for the upcoming election. When a large number of people, at least 40 prominent figures among them, had registered to run for president, the political bias resulted in the elimination of almost every candidate who had political links with the reformists or was favored by like-minded institutions and were barred from the race. The situation at this point is so that out of 7 esteemed presidential candidates, 5 definitely belong to the principalists, and the 2 others don't represent the reformists.
Well now, the more conservative or principalist walk of Iran's political spectrum wouldn't want to leave that unanswered. I got to talk to a couple of parliamentarians to hear them on whether the Guardians might have made a political decision, when in fact they are to vet candidates based on their legal credentials and existing documents. Mr. Nouruzi is vice chief of the Parliamentary Legal Committee.
اگر اصلاحات یک شخصیتی رو که ضعف نداشت معرفی می‌کرد.
Anyway, if the reformists hadn't introduced weak or problematic figures, they would definitely have the chance to see their candidates approved. I'm not a member of the Constitutional Council, but my question is, why didn't the reformists introduce Mr. Arif? Why didn't they put forth figures who could be qualified to run? Anyhow, they endorse people like Mr. Jahangiri, who have their own problems. Mr. Jahangiri has to be accountable for the economic problems in the past 8 years, because he has been the first vice president, a position comparable to the country's prime minister. He can't come forward and complain. He must first explain what he's been doing in the past 8 years and then run for president.
Besides Mr. Raisi, the judiciary chief, other principalists approved to run are Saeed Jalili, former Supreme National Security Council secretary and nuclear negotiator, Mohsen Rezai, Expediency Council Secretary, as well as MPs Ali Reza Zakani and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi. Non-principalists are Abdel Nasser Hemmati, Central Bank of Iran former governor, who's a moderate, and Mohsen Mehralizadeh, reformist, former vice president. Registration and vetting and campaigning make for an intricate electoral procedure, intricate like Iran's political system of several member bodies, each presiding over the other. Everything is detailed and foreseen in the hope of leaving no room for error. But then, with too many hands at work, it can, like bureaucracy, trip itself up. And there's human error that can presumably occur with these supreme deciding bodies. Sometimes, as in the case of Larijani, despite the fact that he is a veteran, the Supreme National Security Council's decision to ban first-degree relatives of candidates from studying abroad leads to disqualification.
We don't have anything called disqualification in the presidential election. In fact, we assess the qualification of those who run. This doesn't mean that those who aren't approved are unfit or incompetent for other tasks or positions. What Article 155 stipulates is that the qualified president must meet a set of conditions, including being a political or religious figure, being a resourceful manager, being a citizen of Iran and of Iranian origin. Members of the Constitutional Council consider these conditions for every candidate and finally announce whether or not the individuals are eligible to run for president after a secret ballot.
Mr. Zakir is chief of the Parliamentary Article 90 Committee.
Mr. Larijani has been more of a principalist than a reformist. If he's rejected, it wasn't because he was a reformist. If candidates request explanations about why they have been disqualified, the Constitutional Council can tell them. The candidate can also make it public. There's no legal prohibition against it. But there is usually a convincing reason and expert work behind the decision.
Sometimes the case of Mr. Mehr Alizadeh can find itself repeated. He was disqualified in one election due to the fact that a case was pending against him, but in the next round he was approved due to acquittal.
According to Article 115 of the Constitution, the president must meet certain conditions. One is that he must be of Iranian origin. The other is that he must be a political or a religious figure and be a resourceful manager. None of these conditions are biased for or against any group, camp, or political organization. The conditions consider the candidate's talents, policymaking, and management capabilities in running the country and solving its problems.
It's an executive hand that's in charge of jump-starting and finalizing the election process in practice. That's the Interior Ministry. Pursuant to Article 48 of the election law, executive boards send the names of candidates to four authorities for screening. Those are the judiciary, the Ministry of Intelligence, the police, and the Civil Registration Organization. Now, how Guardian Council members themselves are appointed and what the composition of the body looks like, you may care to know. Of the 12 jurists, six of them are experts in Islamic law and they are appointed by the leader, who is himself elected by the Assembly of Experts. The other six civil jurists are nominated by the Supreme Judicial Council and appointed by Parliament or Majlis. The Council also has six lawyers recommended to Parliament by the head of the judiciary to be confirmed and included in the Council.
Following the Islamic Revolution of 1979, although the Constitution has it that the members of the Guardian Council must be changed every 6 years, 3 years after the establishment of the Guardian Council, six members from amongst both batches of the jurists, Islamic and civil, were changed. This policy was adopted in order to prevent any temporary closure of the Guardian Council. This way, the council will always have six definite members. As a result, the system is so that six members of the 12 members of the Guardian Council undergo a reshuffle every 3 years.
Regarding the council's participation in national events, our MPs speak of how it safeguards the Islamic revolution through these, say through elections.
According to the Constitution, the president is the country's second most important figure after the leader. He's the one who has to execute cultural, social, political, commercial, monetary, financial, banking, petrochemical, and other laws. Any candidate who wins the election must be able to bring everyone together from across the country. If this happens, the revolution thrives and the country will be united. If the elected president is chosen based on meritocracy, the country will be united, free of conflict, and revolutionary. The Constitutional Council is responsible to ensure that. The council has thought for some 800 hours to select which candidate can run the country for the next 4 or 8 years.
I said the Guardian Council is inseparable from the country's system of legal and political governance as it stands. Interestingly, even its critics, at least domestic political ones, don't criticize it as a body.
We shouldn't criticize the Constitutional Council itself. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution has also stressed, we should protect the prestige and identity of the legal institutions as enshrined in the Constitution. But we can criticize the performance of the Council's members. During the leadership of late Imam Khomeini, if the members of the Constitutional Council made any mistakes, he would criticize them and advise them to correct their behavior. We should question those who didn't vote for Mr. Larijani and ask them to explain what their argument has been.
Now, whatever strategy or insight might leave the last man standing, it's all for elections to be held for the people to choose a new president. Incumbent President Rouhani's second term is coming to a close, with very little time left for the Vienna JCPOA talks to conclude in sanctions relief for Iran. Any success the outgoing government has with the talks would be cause for greater voter turnout mid-June. I'm only half done, but it's time to give other media outlets time for their say as well. So for a quick media review, stay tuned. And here's words they put it in. Fars News reads, leader asks Iranian people to stage large turnout in elections. During a meeting via video link with members of the Iranian parliament on Thursday, May the 27th, Ayatollah Khamenei first thanked all individuals who were nominated to run in elections. Many of these people undoubtedly entered the scene because they felt a responsibility to, he said. Secondly, Ayatollah Khamenei said, I have to doubly thank those whose qualification was not approved and was not ascertained by the council and who reacted nobly. Some of them even encouraged people to participate in the election. The leader said the fact that the Constitutional Council had not been able to ascertain the qualification of certain candidates did not mean that those individuals were not qualified. They may even be highly qualified. What it meant was that the council had not been able to determine such a qualification based on its own recognition, the reports, and the available tools. Dear Iranian nation, election takes place in one day, but its outcome is there for several years. Participate in the election. Consider the election as belonging to yourselves, because it does belong to you, Ayatollah Khamenei said. Tehran Times quotes the council's spokesperson, Kat Khodayi, predicts high voter turnout. In an interview with Press TV on Tuesday, Abbas Ali Kat Khodayi said, when it comes to verification and vetting, the impact of the Constitutional Council's votes on the people's participation is very little. That, he said, is what opinion polls conducted by state institutions show. It's usually most likely about economic issues and maybe some political and social issues. He said the council carries out its responsibilities based on the constitution as the fundamental law of the country and is duty bound to do the vetting process. If a person is vetted and not approved, we are not to blame. We have to act on the basis of law. We have Abna referring to a Sunni cleric saying vigilant nation attends election to decide for its fate. A Sunni Friday prayer leader in southeastern Iran believes that the Iranian nation are vigilant and will participate in the upcoming presidential election across Iran to decide their own fate. Molavi Abdurrahim Rigyanpur, Sunni Friday prayer leader of Mirjave, a city in southeastern Iranian province of Sistan-Balochistan, made remarks in an interview with IRNA. Participation in the elections is a religious duty, and respect for objectives of Imam Khomeini, the father of the Islamic Revolution, the Sunni cleric said. During the past past years, enemies, arrogant powers, and global Zionism have in vain been trying to downgrade the people's participation in Iran's elections, he added. Despite the sanctions, Iran will powerfully stand on its own feet, the Sunni cleric stressed. That would be it for this segment. Do stay tuned. Foreign policy will no doubt pose pretty potent challenges for any new president and his cabinet. Let's hear what they will face from our show guests.
The president must run the country. It is not possible to run a country without interacting with the world. We have had relationships with all the world when both principalists and reformists were incumbent, with a few exceptions like the occupying Israel regime. As a matter of fact, if principalists win the upcoming election, they would have greater interactions with the world. We want to maintain our country's authority.
Now, the main challenge any new president would face in this country has got to be economic. That is why the JCPOA talks matter. To Iran, the whole point of the talks is that US and E3 economic sanctions be lifted off this country. Only then will a US return to the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal even matter to us.
You see, our economic structure is really in shambles. Our currency and tax system are in disarray. There are so many unemployed youths. 12 million young people aren't getting married because they don't have a home. While the Minister of Roads and Urban Development says he doesn't believe in cheap housing options just for the sake of being stubborn and based on his personal beliefs, it's evident that the country won't thrive. I think the Constitutional Council can intervene here and choose capable candidates fairly, regardless of their political orientation. They should approve people who won't make the society bipolar or tripolar or sow discord and only consider themselves.
Interestingly, not all Iranian authorities see sanctions as wholly bad. In fact, the absolute majority see a use in sanctions alongside the vice. That is getting closer to independence, because with deprivation comes resistance economy. That's moving to mobilize the country's industry, hence independence. That is not to say sanctions are not a nuisance, of course, even to domestic manufacture. Developing domestic manufacture can be achieved with technology transfers and investments made possible by the lifting of sanctions. This in turn would enable greater growth and lucrative exports for Iranian industries. And fortunately, in the absence of Western alliance, Iran still has some useful friends elsewhere.
He won't be just the president, but someone whose performance shapes the country's political future for at least the next 10 to 20 years. Our citizens' psychological comfort and economic security are affected and take shape by the president's policies on economic issues as the country's senior executive manager. This is unanimously agreed upon. Society expects the same. So do our political elites, the incumbent government, and most importantly, the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
We popped out and learned what people think of shortcomings and what they expect of their next president.
One of the most serious problems is that people's purchasing power is very weak. There's tremendous economic pressure on them.
I expect the new president to care more about the youth. All the young people are unemployed. Some of them want to leave the country. They don't want to stay in Iran. The most urgent priority is employment.
Anyone who wants to be president in the new term, as the leader said, must be the most efficient politician and fully familiar with the flaws in the system.
One priority is the creation of jobs for young people, which has been very weak. The other is the astronomical prices. Another is enabling young people to get married. One of the main weaknesses of our current president is that he has not fulfilled any of his promises so far.
The least the next president is expected to do is to care for those who live in a poor economic situation.
People's most important demand is that the president be able to address their problems and create jobs.
Like many things related to Iran, its Guardian Council comes under international criticism in great part due to the country's system of governance being anew. It's a democracy with a name, an Islamic democracy. The Guardian or Constitutional Council as a legal body is not dissimilar to any other in the world. In France, the Constitutional Council is the highest constitutional authority.
The principle of supervision is observed by all countries, whether those in Europe, the US, or elsewhere. But the methods differ according to the nature of the countries. Considering that our constitution has a religious basis, part of the responsibility of the Constitutional Council is to ensure that the resolutions don't violate religious laws. The Council's members generally are tasked with ensuring that the passed laws are based on the Constitution.
Its duties are first the supervision of elections and ensuring the legitimacy of referendums. That's going by Articles 58, 59, and 60. And second, the interpretation of the fundamental meanings of the Constitution, legislation, and treaties.
It is a Zionist thought to polarize the elections. The instance is Trumpism or Bidenism. They polarize the society, and instead of proposing their plans, they locked their horns and got involved in their private affairs, shouted and insulted each other. The result was that Congress came under a deadly attack. Our elections don't polarize the people. The election is multipolar. Different personalities are nominated and qualified, will later compete in a healthy environment and are chosen by the people according to their plans discussed during ethical debates.
To get back to Iran's Guardian Council and elections, the Council's 25th May approval of finalists meant those candidates could start campaigning until June the 16th, 2 days before the election. That would allow for a one-day period when campaigning is banned. Candidates will have three televised debates, which could swing the vote against all expectation, as they have done so with the past three presidents. The Interior Ministry has said it could extend voting until 2 a.m. on June the 19th, since the polls will not operate at full capacity in order to observe COVID-19 guidelines.
The reformists are now considering the options in a situation where their prominent nominees, including Mr. Assaf Jahangiri, Mr. Pezeshkian, Mr. Mohsen Hashemi, Mr. Shariat, and others are rejected. They are probably planning to endorse the two reformist leading candidates for now and decide on who would withdraw from the race in favor of the other on the eve of the election day based on their popularity in opinion polls.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. But do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as there's plenty more to be said on the elections in weekly shows and even our 10-minute specials in the run-up to the election, 18th June. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: وجدت في الكتاب، يعني كتابا لعلي عليه السلام، أن قيمة كل امرئ وقدره معرفته. إن الله تبارك وتعالى يحاسب الناس على قدر ما آتاهم من العقول في دار الدنيا.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "I found written in the book which is ascribed to Imam Ali alayhi salam that the worth and value of every man is his knowledge. Verily, Allah, blessed and most high, will take people to account according to his intellects that he has given them in this world's life."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in many beautiful conversations conducted by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings be upon him, he had these beautiful conversations and these dialogues with his companions, talking about different social etiquettes, different forms of behavior, different Islamic etiquettes which are appropriate and are proper for a human being to inculcate within them. So Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam would talk to his companions, of course, among the very many countless and multiple things that Imam al-Baqir talked to his companions about. One of those things, of course, is these kind of codes of conduct, this behavior that a human being should have. Now, these are social etiquettes and they are behaviors which, in reality, are a guidance for the perfection of not just the individual, but of society and humanity as a whole. If an unbiased and unprejudiced individual goes and reads these social conducts and these social etiquettes put forth by Islam, and in this situation, or in this case, by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the unbiased individual will surely see that these Islamic etiquettes are geared towards a utopian society. They are geared towards an ideal society which is made up of perfect and ideal human beings. So in this specific dialogue with his companion, Imam al-Baqir talks to him about using useless words. He talks about clinging to silence. It's interesting, we say that silence is golden. But of course, just keep in mind that this is not an absolute, because when you are faced with an oppressor, or if you are faced with the oppression of an oppressor, or if you witness the oppression of an oppressor, then silence is not golden. In that situation, silence is actually bad. But anyways, back to what we were saying, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said to his companion that indeed, surely, definitely, don't have a doubt about this, that the tongue is the key of all good and evil. Dear friends, what a beautiful statement in this conversation, in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir with his companion, where he says that this tongue, this small piece of muscle, this small piece of flesh, if you will, which is within our mouths and should be under our control, is such a powerful weapon. It is a powerful tool which can be used for all kinds of good, but it can also be used for all kinds of evil. And so we have to be very, very careful to control our tongue. We must be very careful on how we use our tongue. What kind of speech do we speak? What kind of words do we say? Do we speak the words of truth and justice? Or do we use and speak the speech of oppression and tyranny? Do we use our tongues to speak the truth, or do we use our tongues to speak lies and cheat and deceive and corrupt? This small piece of flesh, but so powerful that it can change hearts, it can guide hearts towards light and truth, but it can also misguide hearts towards darkness and evil. Beautiful wisdom brought to us by this dialogue from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Imam al-Baqir had a wasiyyah, a will. Part of his will was to Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayh, that for 10 years in Mina, the 7th of Dhul Hijjah is when believers start gathering for Hajj. The recommendation is before Yawm al-Arafah, which is the 9th, and Yawm al-Tarwiyah, which is the 8th, for the believers to gather in Mina. The Imam passed a day before that, or was martyred, rather, a day before that. For 10 years, he said to his son, for him to commemorate the demise, the shahada of Imam al-Baqir in Mina, so that the believers, the Muslimun, those who knew of the Imamah of the Ahlul Bayt, those who were oblivious to that, to all hear about the demise and really the Shahada of Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayh, which is itself this particular will, this wasiyyah of Imam al-Baqir, shows that he was trying to get a message across, similar to Imam al-Husayn, that after his Shahada, the commemoration of Imam al-Husayn was something that was upheld by the Ahlul Bayt ever since. Imam al-Baqir wanted the commemoration of his demise where all Muslimin can see and hear about it, because there was something about it, and that is that the authorities caused his death. And so it's a death of shahada, martyrdom, as we have in other ahadith. Although, unfortunately, as we've said before, the details of that martyrdom have not been shared with us. We don't have much explanation as to how it occurred, but clearly the various ahadith, including this will of Imam al-Baqir, tell us that the Imam did not pass away a natural death.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.